Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Tour Guide Tell All. On Sundays, we do short episodes, highlights of hidden sites in Washington, D.C. And this week, Rebecca and I are going to talk all about George Mason.
Hi, this is Rebecca. This memorial is particularly near and dear to my heart. I got my master's at George Mason University, which is right outside of Washington. And it's also where I met my husband's. And he's okay. So it's kind of a special spot. George Mason, before I get to the memorial, a little bit about the man. George Mason is, like I tell people on my tours, he's the most important founding father that you've never heard of. You've never heard of him because he gets into a fight with the one person you don't want to get into a fight with if you want to go down in history. And that is George Mason gets into a fight with George Washington. They start out as friends, and then they have this very big falling out.
I cannot picture George Washington getting into a fight with anybody, physically, mental, emotionally, verbally. That is not how I picture him. But Rebecca, you're right. George Mason has kind of been relegated to the recycling bin of American history, kind of really only being brought up again with constitutional historians, American Revolutionary buffs, those who went to George Mason University. Whenever I ask guests on tours if they know who George Mason is, I'm kind of met with a blank stare. Whenever I take groups to the George Mason Memorial, I like to read this little clip and then see if they can tell me who wrote it. That all men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights, of which, when they enter into state of society, they cannot, by any compact, deprive or divest their posterity. Namely, the enjoyment of life and liberty, with the means of acquiring and possessing property, and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. So I always read that, and people are like, oh yeah, that's the start of the Declaration of Independence, which it is not. It is actually from George Mason's Virginia Declaration of Rights. So obviously, Thomas Jefferson had read that at some point before drafting the Declaration of Independence. So Rebecca, tell us why George Mason should both be better known and isn't anymore.
The reason that he should be better known is because he was at the Constitutional Convention. He was very influential in drafting not only the U.S. Constitution, but particularly the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. To back up a little bit, George Mason is from Virginia. His home of Gunston Hall is in Fairfax County, which is really not all that far from Washington, D.C.
Though we should point out that Washington, D.C. was not a place when George Mason was here. So close, not so far away now.
Right. He actually is neighbors with George Washington. Mount Vernon is about 3 miles away from Gunston Hall. And during the American Revolution, he actually is in the Virginia State Legislature, the House of Burgesses. He is very instrumental in drafting not only the Virginia State Constitution.
And this is where he drafts the Virginia Declaration of Rights, correct?
Right. Gets a national profile from doing this, but he doesn't seem to want to be on the national stage. He seems to have been uninterested in traveling, and he, rather than go to the Continental Congress during the American Revolution, he actually stays in Virginia for the whole of the war. Because, though, his national profile is so large, when the Founding Fathers get around to drafting the Constitution in 1787, his expertise is needed, and they ask him, basically, George Mason, to come to Philadelphia to help draft the Constitution. And in fact, it's the only time he really leaves Virginia for the Virginia area for his whole life. He goes and he brings with him his previous experience, the Constitution in Virginia and the Bill of Rights. And you can sort of see his fingerprints are all over the Constitution. He's very involved with James Madison in drafting large sections of the Constitution. And he's very, very focused on the Bill of Rights. Now, today, we all think of the Bill of Rights as being an integral part of the Constitution, and of course they are, but They're the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. So they were not actually part of the original Constitution. And that's the sticking point for George Mason. He wants to make sure that these 10 amendments, these freedoms, are put in the Constitution from the first moment. It's how important he thinks these rights are. George Mason is really afraid of a very overpowerful executive and wants to make sure that these freedoms are enshrined, sort of sending the message down through the ages that these freedoms were important enough to actually be in the Constitution. And he really advocates for this. But just the Constitutional Convention just can't get it done in time. And so they draft the Constitution. The Bill of Rights, as we know it, is not a part of the original Constitution. And this is going to be George Mason's really big problem. He refuses to sign the Constitution until the Bill of Rights are added in. That's how important he thinks this is. He really puts his foot down. James Madison will sit down with him and say, look it, I know that these are important, and I promise you, the first session of Congress, this will be the first thing that we do. We'll make sure that these get added, but we just can't get it done right now. And George Mason holds firm, and eventually George Washington himself, his friend and neighbor, will sit him down and say, look it, you know, we've been here for weeks. It's really hot. They're doing this in the summertime behind closed doors to keep secrecy. And obviously, air conditioning hasn't been invented yet. And the summer that they're drafting the Constitution is actually the hottest summer on record in Philadelphia. And so George Washington says, look it, pal, we'll get to it, but we're hot and uncomfortable and there's no air conditioning and we all just want to go home. So can't we just agree that we'll get to it and deal with this later? And George Mason's like, nope, I can't agree to that. I can't abide it. I want to make sure that these rights are protected. And he leaves in a huff. George Mason basically packs up his stuff and goes home rather than sign the Constitution. This is sort of his protest.
Right. And only, there are actually three men who didn't sign the Constitution. Or I should say only three men did not sign the Constitution out of the, was it 55 people who were there? Though I guess there's 39 signatures on the Constitution and 55 people who were there. But we always talk about the three men who didn't sign the Constitution, mainly because of this lack of Bill of Rights. So the missing numbers are, you know, people who got sick or just had left the convention early. But along with George Mason was Elbridge Gerry, who is kind of claim to fame is the word gerrymandering, which we pronounce wrong because he pronounced it Gary. I guess it's the whole GIF debate. But he's buried here in Washington, D.C. at a congressional cemetery, so we should talk all about him on a future episode. But I digress. Mason, George Washington, go.
And his relationship with George Washington never recovers. They're never friends again. George Mason does live long enough to see 2 years later in 1789, when the first Congress does sit, that is one of the first priorities of the new Congress is to pass the Bill of Rights. And of course, today, because of that, it is an integral part of our Constitution. So he does get to see it added to the Constitution before he dies in 1792.
I always think it's a little unfair that as students of history or students of American history, learning about the Bill of Rights, it's always James Madison, father of the Bill of Rights. But we have George Mason, who was a part of it from the very beginning and wanted this desperately enough that he wouldn't even sign the Constitution. So I feel like the Bill of Rights, or I feel like George Mason ought to get some credit for the Bill of Rights. So I looked it up. The Bill of Rights entry on Wikipedia only mentions George Mason's name 6 times. And I feel as someone who had an integral part in protecting our individual freedoms that he ought to be included just a little bit more. And, you know, before quarantine, I used to edit Wikipedia pages so I could make a joke about how I have more time now to do so. But I don't. I don't have any more time because my children are home from daycare. So the memorial is, like yours, one of my favorite places off the beaten path. And I really do mean it's off the beaten path. If you stand on the corner of Ohio Drive and I guess the other part of Ohio Drive, where people walk over the bridge at the tidal basin and then they turn left to head to the Thomas Jefferson Memorial. You could stand there for a good hour and probably see, on a normal spring day, 1,000 people make that left turn to walk to the Jefferson Memorial, with maybe only 5 crossing the street to head over to the George Mason Memorial. So it very much is something that people walk by all of the time.
To talk about his memorial, George Mason dies kind of obscure, but his sort of fame has been growing as his contribution to the Constitution and to the Bill of Rights has sort of been more and more recognized. And in 1990, there was the idea that we should have a memorial for him. And they break ground for it in 2000. It's completed 2 years later. And where it is today, it's sort of tucked behind the Jefferson Memorial on the Tidal Basin. It's one of those memorials that you drive by and you think, oh, huh, I wonder what that is and who George Mason is. And then you forget it about 2 seconds later because there's Franklin Roosevelt's memorial and Martin Luther King. So it's kind of a minor memorial that unfortunately, due to its placement, kind of gets missed by a lot of people. But it's pretty neat. What it is, there is as you approach it, there's a big fountain. And sometimes the fountain even works.
Only sometimes.
Which is really nice. It's surrounded by lovely trees. There's a trellis covering over 2 large benches made out of stone. On one of the benches sits George Mason's statue. And he's sitting next, he's kind of lounging actually. He's like laid back, like very relaxed. He's got a couple of books next to him, his tri-corner hat, and his walking stick. And the books, he actually has his finger in one of the books, sort of holding his place. The 3 books, the one that he's reading is going to be by Cicero. The other 2 volumes are by John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. So they're all about the social contract and good governance. And sort of basically the idea is that these are the texts that he consulted when he was creating the Bill of Rights in our Constitution. So it's really neat sort of symbolic memorial. But the thing that I like to point out to people when I take them to the George Mason Memorial, the sculptor, whose name is Wendy Ross, but this particular statue, when she created it, Wendy Ross is generous to George Mason in one particular aspect of his anatomy.
Rebecca.
And no, I'm not talking about that particular aspect. Wendy Ross gives George Mason in his statue very well-defined, well-sculpted calf muscles. So the lower part of his leg, he's got very meaty calves. And this is a big deal. In George Mason's day, calf muscles, and I know this is going to sound insane, but calf muscles were considered an attractive part of a man's anatomy. This was something, it was eye-catching. Big, meaty calves were considered to be sexy even. And so this was a part that men would show off if they had sort of well-defined calf muscles. And the reason is it's a wealth signifier. So if you had well-defined calf muscles, that basically meant you could afford the time to ride a horse all the time. That's how you get these very well-defined calf muscles, by riding a horse. And so if you have very nice calves, you obviously are wealthy because you spend your time riding horses all over the place. Men's fashion reflects this. George Mason in his statue, along with the other, if you go to see Thomas Jefferson, etc., the fashion for men at the time was knee breeches, which are pants that are going to end just below the knee. And so men would be wearing these pants, and under that, their calves would be encased in stockings, kind of like pantyhose today, but they're very thin. And so they sort of show off these very well-defined and well-muscled calves that men are having, and that they want to show off to the ladies, right? You know, if you're a single guy and you're trying to attract a wife, you want to show off these meaty calf muscles. It tells the woman that you are wealthy and you can afford to ride a horse all the time. So this is a very attractive quality. And that's part of the reason men's fashion sort of has these knee breeches. And
along those same lines, if you think think of the shoes that men wear at that time. And I always imagine it, those buckle shoes with the little heel that you had during the Thanksgiving productions in elementary school. Those little heels kind of help accentuate the calf muscles as well. And if you get a chance to look at the statue up close at all, and I hope that you do at some point on a visit to Washington, D.C., also have a look at his gut. You'll notice that he has a little bit of a beer belly, and it kind of folds over his pants, his buttons, showing that he had a healthy and hearty diet. You know, I guess our thought processes have changed a lot on what makes an attractive man, or depending, I don't know. I don't know what your preferences are, but back then, a little bit of a beer belly and really large, meaty calves was a sign of prosperity and that he would be able to take care of you. And that is what women cared about.
In those days, when men would greet women, they would, of course, bow and take off their hats, but they would sweep their hats low against their calf muscles as they bowed to sort of draw women's eyes towards those sexy calves.
I wish there was a way that we could show you the movements that we do during this line on tour. Well, I guess there is a way. You can come and join us on a tour sometime. But if you imagine that you are a woman at this time and you meet a gentleman and he wants to show you that he has the ability to care for you and that he leads a life of leisure, what he would do would pick whichever calf muscle was larger and put that out. And so what he would be doing is putting his best foot forward, in case you have ever heard that phrase before. Now, we always use it kind of meaning, you know, whatever our skills, first impression kind of idea. But this is, it was very literal. You would put your best foot forward when you were meeting a prospective suitee. Is that the word I'm looking for? Because if I was the suitor, a prospective person that you would like to court.
So the idea that the sculptress, Wendy Ross, gives George Mason these very generous calf muscles, she's kind of, you know, doing him a little bit of a favor as far as signaling his wealth and his importance. The memorial's really lovely, out-of-the-way spot tucked behind the Jefferson Memorial, and very much a hidden gem in Washington, D.C.
I want to give a shout out to Chris Railing, if he's listening, because he probably did the delivery of the story the best when he was a guide with us here in Washington, D.C. So hi, Chris. Chris signed up to be a patron on our Patreon page, so I know that he's listening to this a few days before everyone else. One of the perks is early access to our podcast. If you want that and a number of other awesome things, please help support Tour Guide Tell All by becoming a patron. You can also, because it would be awesome if you did both, buy a gift certificate on our website, dcbyfoot.com, and you can join us on our National Mall and Tidal Basin 4-hour tour to see this story acted out, because we all have developed historically accurate and flourishing bows to go along with this story. So that is this week's mini episode of Tour Guide Tell All. We look forward to chatting with you next week about, you know, I have no idea. So you know what listeners should do? You should follow our new Twitter account at Tour Guide Tell, and we will post that information there. So thanks for listening.
Thanks so much, guys.